Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Global Research, our mindlessness, is brought to you by globalresearch.ca and my co-host, Michelle Chosudovsky. He'll be back on. He's been teaching world traveling, and he'll be back on hosting programs beginning in January after the holidays. And we have an expanded schedule now. Again, a reminder, we're on at our new time, 1 hour earlier at 10 a.m., and we go 5 days a week at this hour. Currently, live programs Monday and Tuesday, repeat programs the rest of the week. This program will be repeated Wednesday. Tomorrow's program will be repeated Thursday. This one, again, will be repeated Friday live, and all programs are archived for easy listening. My guest this morning is a very distinguished economist, one of the best around, and one of the best explaining the current economic situation in the country that seems to be sinking lower and lower, worse and worse, despite all of the glory comments that come through the major media telling us about how the worst is past and it's all uphill from here. My guest is Michael Hudson, and Michael has had a very long, varied and distinguished career. He's been on Wall Street. He's a leading economist. He's a financial historian. He's a research professor at the University of Missouri. He's also a fierce critic of the Bush administration's efforts to bail out Wall Street and reward the criminals that got us into this mess in the first place, hollow out the country, suck wealth from us, the public, to the elite 1%. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back on again. You sent me a piece that you wrote that will be part of a film, and I asked you to come on after I read your article. The Obama letdown. Well, it's hard to imagine anybody would not expect a letdown, but you know the way the public mind works. People hope for the best, even the best and brightest hope for things they'll soon enough discover won't happen. But let me just read a couple of lines from both. In your Obama letdown article, you talk about how reality raised its ugly head. Obama was elected to bring us change, but the kind of change that will happen will not be what most people are hoping for. And you mention in your first paragraph that the top 1% of the nation's wealthy 10 years ago at about 37% of the nation's wealth. 5 years ago, it was up to 57%. Today, it really is an astonishing 70%. I shudder thinking what it'll be 10 years from now. 90%? 95%? I mean, it really is shocking because this trend is very much in place. And then the piece you sent me that you wrote about the film, and a little bit of it was clipped off. I think the top line was what the financial sector wants. What's Wall Street's basic strategy? And you write, first off, first it wants to shift taxes off of itself. We're talking about Wall Street, the financial industry. It wants to shift taxes away from itself and its major client, real estate. So these taxes have to go somewhere. They're going to go to industry, but mostly they're going to go on us. And you go on, and you explain this in great detail. Let me let you take over. And in we got a break coming up. I used up the first segment. We've got a brief break coming up, Michael. We'll come back, and I'll let you take over and explain this. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with economist Michael Hudson. Michael, let me let you jump in. Just one quick comment. I also wrote an article called Obama's Economic Dream Team with a question mark, and I went through the rogues gallery of top people he's appointed, from the Treasury Secretary on down. We've still got Bernanke running the Fed, but let me let you jump in and talk about what you've written about, important material.
Well, the problem is that the economic managers are basically drawn from the financial sector. Wall Street has a veto power over whatever economist or administrator for the Treasury or the Federal Reserve is going to be appointed, and they usually have their own lobbyists, and that's what Summers is the new economic advisor. It's what the whole group of people who were put around Robert Rubin in and Clinton's administration were doing. And the financial sector's objective is basically to get the entire economic surplus pledged as debt service and paid out as interest. Let me explain this. If you're looking at any economy in history, the question is, who's going to get the economic surplus? Now, in antiquity, governments absorbed the surplus as taxes. They taxed everybody, and they used it mainly to set up an army and wage wars. An alternative would be in feudal times, the governments invaded countries like the Norman invasion of England. They divided it up the land and gave it to the landlords. Well, the landlords took as much of the surplus as they could for themselves and kept it in a form of rent to become rich. They didn't want to pay taxes to the government, and so they forced the government to borrow. So the government borrowed, and because labor didn't make enough to pay many taxes, and landlords wouldn't, they borrowed and they created monopolies, like the South Sea Company and the East India Companies, to get monopoly profit. So you had economic rent of landlords, you had monopoly profit from government taxes is the main uses of the surplus. Well, gradually, countries had to compete by setting up industry. So industry wanted to use the economic surplus as much as possible for capital formation. And the problem was that labor fought against this, and they wanted to use the economic surplus as much as possible for rising in living standards. Well, industry had some interest in this because higher paid labor was more productive labor, it was more efficient labor, and also paying labor more enabled it to become an internal market to buy what the industry produced. So you had pretty much of a division of the economic surplus into taxes, into rents, into wages, and into industrial profits. But then increasingly, the financial sector wanted to load all of these groups down with debt and take as much as possible in the form of interest. For instance, it wanted to lend against the largest asset in any economy, which is real estate, and would make loans to real estate, and the developers or speculators or even home buyers would pledge pay out the rental value of the real estate in mortgage interest. As the banks found that 70% of their loans in the United States and Canada and in England are mortgage loans, they tried to get the real estate sector as immune from debt as possible. Back in 1930, real estate taxes made up about 70% of state and local revenues. Now they're down to 16%, and the financial sector and real estate have joined together to shift the tax burden on the labor. So gradually, the taxes have been shifted off what the classical economists wanted to place them on, land and monopoly rents and essentially on wealth, and they've been shifted onto labor, and this has made labor very high cost in countries that are becoming financialized. And the whole word financialization has been added to the English language recently to indicate an economy where ideally the bank marketing directors will get together and they'll say, our ideal is for people to pledge all their income, real estate to pledge all its income, and industry to pledge all its income for debt service, and the entire economic surplus in the economy is going to be paid for debt. And this is essentially what's been happening today. A corporate raider will look at a company, say how much profit and cash flow it can generate, and they'll go to a bank and say, lend me the money, I will pay you this cash flow in the form of interest, and I'll hope to come out of all this with a capital gain. Same thing for a real estate speculator like Donald Trump or any of the others. They will look at an office building or home or apartment building, and they'll say, here's how much rent it can generate. I will pledge, and they'll compete against each other to get a bank loan, and the winner is the buyer of the property who will pledge the most rental income to the bank, and that usually ends up all of the rent. And the motto in real estate is that rent is paying interest, so all this real estate that used to get the rent ends up paying it as interest. Most people who buy houses now have to borrow so much money to afford real estate that's being inflated by all of this credit that they have to go into a lifetime of debt in order to get it. And so you have the whole economy being pledged for debt. Now, Obama had all of this finally crashed when the volume of debt kept growing exponentially beyond people's ability to pay. Now, in the past, for the last few centuries, when an economy couldn't pay, it goes bankrupt. And the good thing is that the debts are being written down and the bad loans are written off. For instance, before Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns went bankrupt, mortgages were being sold at 22 cents on the dollar. That's what outside buyers came in to offer Bear Stearns and Lehman. Now, this would have been a good thing if the market was taking its working its way, because you'd have all this huge debt, real estate debt in the economy, being written down to 22 cents on the dollar. That meant that the new buyers of this debt could then turn around to the people who were living in this real estate and say, okay, we can break even by scaling down your debts to only 22 cents on the dollar, and the economy would have been debt-free. The policy that was backed both by presidential candidate McCain and Obama was don't let the debts be written down. Keep all of the debts in place and make the creditors whole on these bad debts by letting them put $8 trillion of bad debts onto the hands of the government. And so the government in the last few months has taken $8 trillion worth of debts onto itself. Now, the bad subprime mortgage debts are only about $1 trillion. That means that $7 trillion of this money taken on was basically not mortgage debt, not subprime borrowers, but Wall Street gambles using junk mathematical models to make derivative trades and hedge funds doing all sorts of gambling, turning finance capitalism into a kind of casino capitalism. There were so many debts that went bad that the government basically is bailing out the gamblers. It's not bailing out the homeowners. It's not bailing out industry. It's not bailing out anybody except the Wall Street gamblers while keeping all of these debts in place. And this is what threatens to push the economy into depression, because all of the surplus income now is going essentially to pay interest and capital gains to Wall Street, not to be invested in new plant and equipment and new hiring, not to be invested in new construction and real estate, not to be invested in real estate and development, but simply to pay the financial sector. And this is a plan for economic suicide, basically.
Michael, on the one hand, Obama was hired to continue this scheme. And number two, it seems to me, and from all you're saying, and I felt this way for a long time, that there's a plot to crash the economy. I mean, these people are going to make countless billions of dollars, trillions of dollars. They can stick it in their pocket. They can do anything they want with this money. And in plain English, I don't think they give a damn what happens to the economy.
I don't think anyone wants the economy to collapse, and I don't think anyone ever has a plot to collapse the economy. What they do have is a fallback plan, that if they make a bad investment or bad loan, they want the government to pick up the tab. So it's not a plot to crash the economy. That is the inevitable result of the junk mathematics that they use. But they don't want to admit this mathematics. They want to believe that they can help things. And I think Mr. Obama believes that when he appoints Mr. Summers and Mr. Bernanke and the other people, that they actually can help rescue the economy. The tragedy is that they can't help rescue the economy, and that these are the people who got the economy into the mess to begin with, just as they got Russia into a mess and third world debtors into a mess at the World Bank when Mr. Summers was running it.
Indeed, but it isn't part of the plan, Michael, to buy assets at a fraction of their previous cost, the same thing we did in Asia from the Asian 1997 crisis. The Russians went their own way. They handed over their economy to their own oligarchs, not ours. So I guess they basically did the same thing.
Well, basically, the United States realized that once you could turn over Russia's property to oligarchs at, say, a penny on the dollar, that the oligarchs would then do what wealthy people do in any other country. They want to get their money out of Russia, and they diversify and they get it out by selling what they've bought at 1 cent on the dollar for 2 cents on the dollar. This makes them billionaires, but it also enables the foreign buyers to buy into Gazprom and Norilsk Nickel and other companies at 2 cents on the dollar. So the idea was for these people to buy cheap and then sell out to foreign investors. And
it worked very well for us. The Clinton
administration
was very
happy. The Russian market was the biggest, fastest-growing market in the world back in 1996. And fund managers who didn't play the market actually were fired from their firms.
We have to take another break, Michael. We'll be right back. Steve Lindman. I'm on with economist Michael Hudson. Michael, I agree absolutely that ideally they would like a vibrant economy. They'd like to have their cake and eat it. They'd like to have all their interest in their pockets and have the economy growing so they can get even more interest in their pockets. But I guess they're making up for it with these trillions that the Fed and Treasury are handing to them. And by my reckoning, they're making everything worse. They may add a little bit of stimulus to keep the game going for a while, but in the end, it's simply building a greater problem that will have to be accounted for at some point down the line. To me, the analogy is like giving a drunk another drink. The drunk may feel good for a while, but the more drinks the drunk takes, the greater the hangover will be in the end. Isn't that essentially what's going on now? With all these trillions being handed out?
The idea is that the solution to the debt problem is to create yet more debt, and you lend the debtors enough money to pay the banks the interest that's due. So essentially, the banks create the credit and give it to the mortgage debtor or Brazil or whoever owes them the money, and the money will be simply paid back to the bank. This is how Ponzi schemes work. One of the advantages of Mr. Madoff going bankrupt a week ago is that the newspapers have been explaining to everybody just what a Ponzi scheme is. And the Ponzi scheme is one where essentially the investors are paid out of new entrants coming in. For the banking sector, a Ponzi scheme is when the banks lend the debtors enough money to pay the interest. And that's exactly what's happening now. The entire economy has been operating in the way that Mr. Madoff has operated on. In other words, you use new credit to pay the interest that's due on the old credit. And what he's doing is simply being repeated on a large scale by the economy at large. So it's worthwhile reading the news stories and seeing exactly how this worked. People have to have faith in the person who's running the system. And so Mr. Obama has, as he says, appointed people with experience. In other words, the experience of getting the economy into the bad debt to begin with. All their experience has been in doing exactly what he was criticizing during the election campaign. So very much like President Carter, he ran an absolutely brilliant election campaign by telling people he'd change and not telling them what the change was. And now they find out the change is going to be more debt, and American living standards will have to fall by about 20%, and 12 million families will have to go bankrupt in order to achieve the change that Mr. Obama is now supporting.
Oh, I think what's going on with the so-called auto bailout is a good example of how workers will be deeply affected by this.
We don't know whether they'll accept the terms. The terms are that unionization has to be broken, that the labor movement in America will be fractured, and that they will have to give up the gains and essentially become reduced to the to the level they were over a century ago, before things were scaled back. And so the first change Mr. Obama wants to do is roll back American history to the position it was before the Progressive Era, destroy the labor union movement, and reduce American workers to serfdom. That's quite a change. I hope the people who voted for him are happy with it.
Oh, well, I agree with you 100%. And they can do it incrementally, Michael.
No, it can't be done incrementally. It has to be done all at once in a step function. You can't do it bit by bit. That's not how society works. When living standards and income goes back, it's a very, very sharp fall. The decline has to be at least 20% in living standards. Life spans have to shorten very dramatically in this country, as they did in Russia. And if we repeat the Russian experience that Mr. Summers used at the dress rehearsal, you'll have rising alcoholism, rising sickness, very bad health, layoffs, beggars. That's the plan that the economic administrators that Mr. Obama has appointed tried out in Russia as a dress rehearsal, and it's being repeated now in the post-Soviet economies, the Baltic states and Hungary. And if you just do the charts and the mathematics, that's what the mathematics add up to.
Oh, last year I wrote about what we did to Russia and how it impoverished the people. An absolutely devastating story. In terms of the auto workers, Michael, I'm thinking about the last labor contract that the UAW agreed to, got the rank and file to vote to approve it. And one of the things they did to get wages down was they came up with a two-tier system. The existing senior employees would continue on their present pay, but all new hires would be hired for half what the senior people are getting.
That's the logical result of a labor movement that's organized along craft movement lines, along particular industry lines, instead of an overall labor package. And these were the criticisms levied already in the 1910s against the AFL.
Well, you're right. They literally want to go back, I guess, to the Gilded Age, when union workers really had no rights, and they didn't really get much of anything. There was a movement that began growing, but I guess didn't do a lot until the 1930s, and then the dire conditions created an opening for labor. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and continue this.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with economist Michael Hudson. Michael, I have no doubt that they are going to make things much worse in this country under Obama. And we do it to all developing countries. We keep them deeply in debt. They can never get out of it. Once in a while, a country like Argentina goes bankrupt. But we managed to find a way out of that. Occasionally they get a little gumption and they'll at least partially default on their debt. But we even did it to post-apartheid South Africa under Nelson Mandela, who was elected to really bring change to that country. And if Nelson Mandela couldn't do it after spending 25 years in prison, he surrendered. I quoted his exact words on what he said when he was confronted point blank. Why did you do this? And he basically said something like, well, Thatcherism is the way for South Africa. In other words, play the game and keep the people impoverished. And they're in worse shape now economically than they were under apartheid.
I think that he probably believed that the free markets would work, and they don't realize that every successful economy in history has been a mixed economy. Soviet countries realized that an economy run entirely by the government didn't have checks and balances and ended up just a bureaucracy that became a kleptocracy itself. But by moving to the opposite extreme, they left a kleptocracy in place, maybe a new one. And neither extreme works. You need a system of checks and balances. And the financial sectors usually fought against this because the system of checks and balances essentially seeks to use the economic surplus to plow into capital formation and rising living standards, not into debt service, not into land rent, and not really into taxes, as long as the government provides a regulatory and planning system. So the whole idea of economic balance has been thrown off by this neoliberalism that really is the opposite of everything that Adam Smith and the John Stuart Mill and the classical economists talked about. They wanted to their idea of free markets was to free markets from rent and interest, is unnecessary social costs. Their idea was to make prices reflect actual cost value, that is a cost of production that was necessary, and rent isn't necessary and interest isn't necessary for a cost of production. It's superimposed. And so about 100 years ago, there was a post-classical reaction sponsored especially by Columbia University in this country with John Bates Clark, Harvard, and Yale, all opposed the German institutionalist and social democratic approach that went hand-in-hand with the progressive era, and began to push a kind of junk economics on the country that didn't look at finance, didn't look at rent at all, that defined all income as being productive. So the national income accounts of this country and other countries don't have, on the one hand, earned income, and on the other, economic overhead in the form of rent and interest. They treat Wall Street gains is contributing to gross national product, and all is wealth creation, where what it really is debt creation. And so we have a whole system of economic accounts that depict all of this economic parasitism is actually being part of wealth creation and rising output. And of course, it isn't at all. It's just the opposite.
And you use a powerful phrase that's part and parcel of this. You say bankers don't earn their money, they extract it.
That's right. It's rent and interest are what the classical economists called rentier income that should be minimized. And it's an unnecessary charge resulting from financial and property rights, not stemming from the means of production itself.
Well, we have a situation now where the debt is getting exponentially greater. It's astonishing. I think the last number I saw on Bloomberg was $8.5 trillion, but who knows how much higher this will go? I mean, it's growing by the trillions, not the hundreds of billions.
You're talking about the bailout, not the overall.
I'm talking about the bailout, yeah. The amount either allocated or pledged. I guess most of it is pledged.
Right. This is government debt taken onto its books from Wall Street. So the government is now in the position of being the debt collector to defaulting homeowners. And to defaulting companies and defaulting hedge funds that have made bad debts. For instance, the government has bailout has taken over $150 billion for just one insurance company, AIG, that was cooking the books, running along crooked lines, and thought it would remake the money it had lost by using junk mathematic models that, of course, it lost in. So on the one hand, you have people calling Wall Street a casino economy. But in a casino economy, the house is supposed to win. And in this case, the house is actually lost.
That's a good way of putting it. I guess part of this, you can explain it far better than I can, but I guess part of this is to exchange toxic debt from these bankers, from the Wall Street crowd, the insurers, the AIGs, for U.S. government treasuries. And I guess that is a big reason why, aside from a flight to safety, supposedly, I guess this trade is one reason why we, in my estimation, I wonder if you agree, we have another enormous bubble, U.S. Treasuries.
That's not really a bubble. That's money that's everybody just moving out of bad. Nobody trusts other banks anymore because the largest banks, they have negative equity. So, there are too many savings to be put in, you know, small, local, rural savings banks. And so they're buying treasury bills because they know the treasury can always print the money. But Citibank has negative equity. Chase Manhattan is supposed to have negative equity. Wells Fargo. All these banks have made such bad loans and investments that these investments can't cover the deposit liabilities. So why would anybody put their money in a bank that has negative equity?
Oh, I agree. Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan Chase is very close to where I live in Chicago. it seems to me I saw something where they were offering CDs at 3 or 4% interest. I don't know if they have it now. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't get 2 cents of my money. I mean, I wouldn't trust them. So I guess technically they're not bankrupt, but they're insolvent. And the government won't let them go bankrupt, so they'll keep them alive.
Mm-hmm. Where do you live in Chicago?
I live downtown.
If you want to see what will happen to America, you can look at what Mr. Obama did in Chicago during his whole political career on the South Side there, basically being part of the group that was gentrifying the South Side. And this gentrification made enormous amounts of money by taking over land from the public sector and tearing down the houses on it and replacing public housing with much more valuable housing and essentially driving the black population south.
Oh, I've seen this happen. I've watched it for many years. I've been here nearly 40 years, Michael. I've seen it fairly close to me where public housing, as you say, public housing.
But you didn't live in downtown. Where did you live before that?
Oh, no, I've lived it all downtown. I live fairly close to the water tower.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen it, gentrification.
So we call that the near north side.
The near north side, exactly. Not too far from where I live. I've seen old decrepit buildings torn down and areas, whether it be a street or a group of streets, slowly gentrified, to get rid of the poorer elements and bring in more affluent people. But the poor are the ones that are harmed. The majority black population of Chicago was terribly harmed, and Obama is it's okay with Obama. He lives in another world. He's part of a different system, and he's a smart guy. He knows what's going on. But
I think it's important to look at how that world operated, and essentially it's the world of real estate reverends, the University of Chicago, the nonprofits. And government played a large role in that. And the lesson there is that most wealth in history in every country has been achieved by privatizing it from the public domain. And that's been the story of Chicago real estate for hundreds of years.
And, of course, one family has controlled the city for so long with minor
breaks. Which families are you referring to? The Crown?
Oh, the Daley family. The Daley family.
So they were only the political front men. It's really the real estate people. For instance, if you look at the Forbes list of the Forbes 400, there are 10 Pritzkers on it.
The Pritzkers
were Obama's.
The Crown family, the Klutznik, I guess he's gone now.
Chicago wealth is really real estate now.
Rubloff, another one. So much real estate, absolutely. And these are names I know well. And I've written about Penny Pritzker as the big fundraiser for Obama, but a very wealthy woman, and of course her family, powerful, wealthy family, Hyatt Hotels, and an awful lot more, very closely connected with Warren Buffett. A former Pritzker. Back in the 1950s, I think, was someone who literally broke Warren Buffett into the investing business. And I think he cut his teeth, learning from one of the elder Pritzkers who's no longer around. Well, now you've got, I forget the names of them all, but the family is still a very powerful local and national family, and real estate, hotels, whatever. This is their game. Can I make a slight change in what we're talking about? We got into this very briefly the last time you were on, and you mentioned that you'd come back from Germany, and there was consensus among a group of economists you got together with that we are heading into a depression, and I guess the environment is very deflationary now. Along with that, it strikes me that at some point in time, you didn't seem to think so, but it strikes me that at some point in time, we face a very severe inflation problem because of all this money that's been created. It's not doing very much. It's just sitting in the banks right now for the most part. But on the one hand, the notion of a deflationary depression, and on the other hand, the possibility that we're talking about at some point in time a serious inflation. Your thoughts on that?
You're going to have both at once. There'll be debt deflation in the sense that more and more income is taken away from salaries and corporate cash flow and paid to the banks. So you're going to have a shortage of purchasing power for goods and services. At the same time, foreign countries, now that foreign investors are not buying U.S. companies anymore, they realize that they're going to lose money on U.S. stocks and bonds. They're not buying U.S. exports because we've post-industrialized the economy. So the dollar is likely to go down very sharply against foreign currencies. This means that the price of imports will rise, and import prices form an umbrella over domestic prices. So you're going to have a rise in the cost of living without really an inflation taking place, in the face of debt deflation, in fact. So you're going to get a squeeze on labor and on industry that's going to essentially wipe out the economic surplus. The surplus will be taken more by finance and property than by industry, so you're not going to have industrial investment. You're not going to have consumer spending on rising in living standards, and you're not going to have the foreigners giving America the free ride that they've been given by essentially accumulating $4 trillion worth of these U.S. Treasury bonds that you've talked about. Foreigners have been financing most of the U.S. Budget deficit by recycling the balance of payments deficit into Treasury bond holdings. That probably is too many words for people who haven't followed the balance of payments to follow. But basically, the balance of payments is in a bad deficit, and if the dollar is falling while there's debt deflation here, you're going to have the prices that people pay rise while their incomes are not rising, and while they have to pay more and more money for debt, for local taxes, for health care, and essentially for monopoly prices generally. So there's a squeeze on.
So on the one hand, countries like China and Japan that typically buy so many of our treasuries, they have their own problems to deal with. And with a deflating dollar, they're probably not going to buy as many treasuries.
It's not their problem. What they're going to do is look for their own domestic market. In other words, China is now saying, okay, if we can't export to America, now we put in place all of this productive power. Let's begin raising standards for our own labor force. Let's pay our own labor enough so that they can afford to buy this these goods and products that we're no longer selling to America. So Chinese living standards will rise, not those of the United States.
What about the prospects of a depression that would be serious enough, whether it's as bad as the 1930s or whatever? What do you see for the prospects of that?
Well, certainly living standards and investment will go down here. It doesn't have to be worldwide unless other countries fail to break away from the American economy dragging them down. It doesn't have to affect Russia, India, Asia. It doesn't even have to affect Europe unless Europe keeps tying its fortunes to the dollar. So it'll be different structurally than it was before. In the Depression, debts were wiped out. This time we're keeping the debts in place, and that makes it an entirely different scenario from what it was in the 1930s.
So do you think that the impossible will really happen? Two impossible things happening, Michael. On the one hand, consumers actually beginning to save. That seemed impossible.
It'll appear in the statistics of saving. In the national income of statistics, when you repay a debt, that's counted as saving. And so there will be a statistical impression that consumers are saving, but this won't be money that's in the bank available to them. This will merely be working down the debt balance that they have, if they can. So there won't be real saving taking place. And the saving that does occur is going to be largely at the very top of the economic pyramid. Most people will not have enough money to save.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention was the possibility. I put a question mark on that. The possibility that Europe, China, and Japan will actually become more independent from us than they have been in the past. They'll go their own way rather than simply be tied to the Washington Consensus way. You wrote about the end of the Washington Consensus, too.
That seems to be likely simply because they don't want to lose money on holding more. What's the point of exporting more to the United States if you have to take the payment in Treasury bills that don't have a chance of being repaid? And nobody's been able to say how the United States can repay the $4 trillion in U.S. Treasury debt to foreign central banks. And if this money can't be repaid, what's the point in giving goods and services and cars and companies in exchange for pieces of paper?
So, in other words, they're going to grow their own economies more. They're going to do more business with each other and rely on a country that's not a deadbeat like apparently they see us to be.
That would seem to be the case.
Gee, it's hard to imagine, Michael, that America would be thought of as a deadbeat country. Still the world's biggest economy, but sinking, not rising. I guess that's our status right now.
It doesn't have to be this way.
Oh, it doesn't have to be that way at all. I mean, it's worrisome. I mean, for me, at my age, looking back at the world I grew up in and to see the state it's in now, it seems almost inconceivable to me, but it's happening in front of our eyes. Let's take another break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with economist Michael Hudson. Michael, there's never enough time to go into everything, and what you have to say is so important. I wish we could keep this going all afternoon. But one thing I want to ask you, is it all right, the piece that you wrote for the film, is it all right to post that on Global
Research? No, I'm rewriting it, so you can't post it yet. I only sent you that as a talking point. I'm in the process of rewriting it.
When it is okay, maybe you could send it to me because it's important information.
At the point that I finish it. But it's
that would be wonderful.
Only a discussion of what we might go over today.
Oh, I sent it to nobody. I simply held on to it because it was something to discuss on this program. But it's important, and when you get it in final form, it would be wonderful information to post on Global Research, all over the Internet, for that matter.
Thank you.
We just have a few minutes left. Let me let you sum up what's going on, where we're heading. People I know, my listeners, I know are very concerned about this, so maybe you could sum up for them.
How many listeners do you have? You know?
I'm sorry?
How many listeners do you have?
We have a small live audience, but we are approaching 100,000 on average downloads per program.
Mm-hmm.
So we're one of Republic Broadcasting's most popular programs. My goal is to make it by far the most popular program because of topics like this, because of guests like you, and we're now on 5 days a week. Right now, only 2 days live. We'll add a third day when Michelle comes back, when he's able to do it. But I'm busy. I simply don't have the time to do it every day. So I go live twice a week. And this program will be repeated Wednesday and again on Friday. So there'll be three live airings of this program. Plus, anyone can access it through the archives. And I want to see it soar well above 100,000 per program. And for a program like this, I wish it could be 500,000. But this is important stuff, the kind of material you never get in the mainstream. And in your film clip piece, you talk about controlling our minds through the media, through all the information channels we have. You talk about so many other important things. But a big one for me is how the sources of communication control the information we get and effectively control our minds, so that we don't really understand, we don't know what's going on. If people knew the half of it, these people would never get away with it, that's for sure.
Well, this is how parasitism works in nature. Most people think of parasites simply as something that attaches itself and sucks the blood or nourishment out of the host. But that wouldn't get parasites very far because they'd all be squashed. Every sophisticated parasite, in order to survive, needs to take over the brain of the host. And it needs to take over the brain so that the host thinks that the parasite is actually part of its own body. And in fact, even thinks of the parasite as a child to be taken care of. And so the parasite basically is a mind control thing. And finally, when it takes all the nourishment out of the host, it makes the host take big, dangerous acts to get the host eaten up. In this case, bailed out by the government or eaten by the government, so that the parasite can jump from the host onto the party that eats the host, in this case onto the government's balance sheet. So if you study how parasitism works in biology, you'll get a clue to how it works in the economy at large.
Oh, indeed. I wish we had more time, but the music says that we're out of time, and they're ruthless, Michael. At the appropriate moment, they'll cut us right off. Let me thank you for coming on. I do hope we can continue this on a future program.
Fine.
Thank you, Michael. And tune in tomorrow. We'll be back. My guest tomorrow will be James Petras. Oh, we have a lot to talk about, so many topics. Come back, and I look forward to being with you.